Greetings to the automatically deleted husband. Besides being tired, I'm kind of disappointed. I didn't get a return postcard today. I did get an advertisement from Spectrum because they wanted me to get their television service, which, anyway. I'm grateful that today I did reach the goal that I had set to be able to receive emails. So Alice at demo.shofarnexus.com is functional. So is Bob and Charles. And I had a couple of people send me emails, and I was delighted. I was really pleased that some people came to the table and it did that. And I've had a conversation. Even had a call from David Tulis inviting me on to if I wanted to get on his radio program to promote it. But the issue is, it's still too geekish, and that's not his audience. I'm grateful for that invitation. But there's two things that I want to make sure are on the table. One is, and I think I'll use it for the image today. Many years ago, early 1990s, I think we started this in 89, if I recall, the HSC 5100, HSC, Heritage Systems Corporation. We had a bunch of products, and we did the 5100 system. It was actually multiple boards, because we had, I'm sorry, the geek here. We had the computer board, and then we had separate I/O boards. The computer board was, this was back when a monochrome LCD display was expensive. And what we did is we got a metal sheet of metal, and on the one side we mounted this. It was about a 12-inch, diameter LCD, 640 by 480, not what we call high resolution for today. And again, monochrome. On the other side of it, we had a power supply, actually with some spacers bolted under the panel. And then on the same side of the display, we had our board. On the same side was on the opposite side. Oh, I don't remember now. Anyway, so we had three items mounted on a metal panel. So it was nice, convenient, as a a single entity to hold. And that unit would be mounted inside of a knitting machine, where the display obviously would be in the door. And hundreds and hundreds of these were made, because these were not cheap. The whole package, I think we sold for about $800 to $1,000 went to each knitting machine of our hardware. Maybe more. I remember because again, the LCD display back then, that was I think a couple hundred dollars by itself. I mean, this was, anyway, but it was a nice convenient package. And on the display, we had a touch panel. I mean, woo! I mean, again, we did this, I think we designed it in 89, if I recall correctly, and started shipping it in 90, or about that. Maybe it was 90, and we were doing that. And a couple of characteristics, because besides that nice little package, we had this unit that had to talk to in a knitting machine, you have, they call them air cylinders, effectively a solenoid that when you put power on it, it would open an air valve, because all the little various mechanical things, instead of being run by, direct mechanical action from a relay or from a solenoid, it was done via air pressure, because, there was a lot of shock advantages and things like that. Anyway, but that's the way it worked. And of course, some of the things, especially like in the knitty needles to develop patterns and whatnot on the sock. I have to make sure I make that link too. Early on, in order to test the fact that I had the software to do patterns and socks, this was, I ended up putting a couple patterns in to demonstrate the sock. One was a little box that said JK in it. Another was a box that said DJ in it. And I actually physically had those socks knitted. Well, actually, it was just the top part of the sock. And I still have them today. Because back then, I was fond of this lady. By the way, I still am. Anyway. But, you know, so that was kind of neat. But there are a couple things that if you look at the board, you'll see on the one end, and unfortunately, you know, the pictures back then were not as clear as they would be today. But on the picture, it's the lower left end. There is a row of eight little 10-pin sockets for these flat ribbon cables. So you'd plug things in. So we could plug eight different devices in it. And we have devices like we have the 5400, HSC 5400 series cards that had various characteristics on it. These were the things with which... when we were in Hanover, Germany for ITMA, the International Textile Manufacturers Association show in 91. 91, for sure. I've mentioned the event before, but I was, you know, it was one of my finest moments. The competition, Lanati, and, it was the other company. Lanati was the matter. Anyway, that had the bulk of the market. They had these huge cards with physical fuses on them. And we had this tiny little card, you know, it was about 4x6. It was metric. 160 by 100, I think. The devices we had protection in it. And so, there was a criticism about, without the fuses, something could go wrong and you'd blow up the card. So the agent we had, who was trying to market it, demonstrated this. But the one time, opened the machine up, unplugged one of the cards, power on, took a screwdriver and just went, across the pins. And it had sparks fly. Plugged it back in, worked fine. And, obviously tiny sparks, but still. But the one time one of the times that it happened is the competition watched it. Kind of like, oh, these people are a problem. It was a delightful moment. It really was a delightful moment. That happened in Hanover, Germany. Anyway, but that cable, one of the characteristics of it is it had a data out, data in, and a clock line isolated with optical isolators. Because we were doing this nice little low voltage 5-volt computer talking to these cylinders and whatnot. They're running 24 volts, so we wanted to have isolation so we would have a very reliable system. And we had a very reliable system. And you'll find if you look at the card to the right of the bottom right, you'll see two devices. There are Xilinxes on it. But the one on the bottom right, these are this programmable logic. And computer fires up the computer. It's the chip kind of in the left-hand side. There's a battery, a round battery, and below it, that's the computer chip. A 32-bit computer. I mean, we were high-tech at this time. This is the Motorola 68332, I believe, was the part number. This was a powerful machine in its day, and it ran at, a 16 megahertz clock, which was divided by four, so it only did 4 million instructions or clocks, semi-instructions per second. Compared to what you have in your cell phone, this is pitifully slow. I mean, less than a thousandth of the speed of a typical cell phone today. But in that day, it was phenomenal. But the one LCA, logical cell array, the computer fired up and it would actually program it to do specific things to turn it into a logical device. And so the one on the bottom right on the image, became turned into a device where the processor could write to a register, and that register would then be shifted out via one of these cables out to one of these boards in order to control it. About the same time, another group of people who were much better funded, had more resources, came out with a similar device, a similar technique. You might be familiar with it. It's called the USB, the Universal Serial Bus, that basically everything uses now. So the same technique. USB at the time was, I think, the fast one was like 12 megabits per second. And we were only running, I think, at 1, if I recall. Because, again, I was resource limited. But still, you know, and again, one guy designed this. Hardware, software, laid out the PC board, did and so forth. So that's what I used to do. And just for reference, the second LCA on there was actually the thing that was the display controller for the LCD. Because, again, that was a marketplace. We made display controllers. That's what was done for, like, the New York Stock Exchange, others. But so that was the device that, again, and you have the next, it's hard to see in the image, but right next to it are four devices. They're in a vertical package, which was interesting, especially for that time. They were called video RAMs because, you know, most memory has just simply a single port. This actually had two. You know, things have changed radically since then. But at that point, there was two ports: one that the computer would talk to, and the other to put data out basically serially, and it went through the LCD, the LCA, and out to the display. Because what it allowed is the LCA was the memory controller. And so when the processor wanted to talk to it, it would effectively go through the LCA to do that. But at the same time, the LCA had the display controller, so it was also independent of the processor grabbing some data and having it go out via this video port. And that's what would drive the display. Anyway, this is, you know, geek stuff from years ago. Techniques have changed radically because now we have very cheap processors to do display controllers. And the processor, you know, here we had one processor that did everything. It ran the serial communications. It did all, generated the stuff for the display and then formatted the stuff on the display, you know, the graphic stuff. It wasn't very fast. And of course, we didn't do any fancy flying things around and whatnot. It also managed the touch panel because that was, again, because, you know, we were kind of ahead of the game. But, you know, things have changed radically. This is really low tech. It's like looking at a Model T, you know. But at the time, it was really amazing stuff. So we had that, and then there's the four other large chips there. They're additional memory. Two were just static RAM. And the reason we had the battery there is because when you turn the card off, the battery was still providing power to two of those chips. So the SOC program, which is what it was, the SOC program in those memory chips would stay there with the power off because the battery would kept it going. And then the other two, you know, way back on some of the earlier products we had, in order to put the program into the device, we used, what was called UV ROMs, read-only memories. This is the device that had the program that you turn the power off, it kept the program in it. But the way they worked is you could program at one time and then it's fine, but they had a glass window at the top. So you put it under an ultraviolet light and it would erase it. And that's, so to reprogram those things took a while because, I mean, it was, I think, several hours under the UV lamp that we had. We did that. It's a fascinating. The story was, because this was originally developed by Intel back in the 70s, because they were doing some, my recollections, they were doing some work in the development of this. And for whatever reason, they had some of these and they had them outside, I think on the roof of a building for, you know, for whatever reason. And in order to find out, hey, sunlight erased it. And it was kind of like they put the pieces together. We now have an erasable device. It's not a problem. It's a benefit. But that's what was done up to that point. What we did, and again, we were really early on this because we paid a premium to do this. You'll see there are no windows on these memory chips, because this is one of the first iterations of what they call EEPROMs. Electrically erasable, programmable, read-only memories. So we could actually update the software without having to unplug things and undo things or replace it. We could actually update the software in the system, which, again, this was really... We were ahead of the game. I mean, this is commonplace. I mean, your cell phone does that. But, your cell phone does. Mine doesn't, because I don't have my cell phone, but that's another issue. So, some of the technology, and of course, there's the kind of oranges device with the little, it's a big transformer. Because the LCD had a fluorescent light bulb, which took, I don't remember, 200-300 volts, whatever it was, and that little board there. So it was all in one package. It generated the power for the light bulb. Of course, fluorescent light bulbs, naughty boys. But anyway, but the whole point of all this, a little trip down. And again, especially to my guys, this is called engineering. Your dad, Walter, Zadok, George, Jack, designed that on his own. I didn't go to school to learn this stuff. I didn't ask my supervisor to tell me how to do this. I did this on my own initiative. Developed a company and sold millions of dollars worth of this stuff. That's your dad's role model. We have other issues, but that's your dad's role model. And I hope perhaps one of you will follow in a somewhat similar vein. You know, because again, the odds of you getting a engineering mind versus, you know, an artistic mind from your dad would be more likely. But anyway, the whole point of all this is, so I told you about a lot of the stuff on the board, but there's one other thing on that board that really was, I would say, a trademark of Heritage Systems products. If you look at the top, there's those four large memory chips, and you go up from that, and you'll see one 20-pin chip there, which was a register, an 8-bit register that the processor could write to. And then you'll see a yellowish, vertical device, a SIP resistor, you know, a single inline package. And then above that, you'll see four green and four red LEDs, little lights. That was a vital aspect of virtually all our products. Some products didn't have it for cost reasons, things of that nature. But most things did. And what was the purpose of that? You put power on this thing. You turn it on. And, you know, when you look at a computer, it's kind of like, what's happening? There's no, you don't see any motion or whatnot. So you don't know, is it working? Is it doing anything? Especially if you don't have a display or something. What's happening? Or if the display doesn't work. So what happened is, and you know, I developed this technique in the 80s and used it, like I say, for a decade. When all our devices, no matter which one they were, they all did the same thing. It fired up and the display would have, the LED display you know, it's always red on the right. So it's two hex digits. So you could see that and read hex digits, and then we'd have a document that say these particular hex values have this particular meaning. But a static display doesn't mean anything. It's kind of like, did it just randomly show up that way when it turned on and we have no idea? So it was a dynamic display, constantly something happening. So it would start off, all the lights would turn on, with one off, and it would shift across to say, I have started up, and I'm letting you know that I'm actually started. And it would, I forget whether left or right, whatever it was. And so the one off would go across, the other seven would be on. And it would take like half a second, because you didn't want to waste time. You didn't want to do. No, it just blip. So for half a second, you'd see the quick thing. And then it would actually kind of do an erratic count, because it would show you, okay, I'm doing test number 4, number 7, number 24, number 32, and whatnot. So you'd see those things happen. Some of those tests were extremely fast. Some of them were slow. For example, when the memory chips were tested. So you had half a megabyte. We had a lot of memory back then of those video RAMs. And so when that was tested, it took a moment. But then when all the tests were done, that sign-on sequence would happen in reverse, the one off LED going across. And then you start the normal process. The normal process is one light, and it would go shift. And that would take about a second, I think, to go across. Or was it 1 second per each? I don't remember. No, I think it took about a second to go across. Because this way, I can look at the board, and I see that one little light going across and say, oh, that board's running. That was the whole purpose of that. Anyway, it became our trademark. And again, I say one of the great, great things was to walk into the because you could see it on the commodity training floor of the New York Stock Exchange, because there was that mezzanine up high, and the rack was there with all the boards that were running those displays, together, and all the lights, big rack of them. So you had a whole bunch of them. When Richard, my partner, when he was could manufacture them, we had a rack, and he had a whole bunch of them in the rack that would be constantly testing. So you have a rack of, we do 10, 20 at a time, and we would burn them in overnight, at least, let them run to make sure they were working. And, so you have this rack. Anyway, this was fun. But what was the point behind that? All this spiel that I went on, what was the point behind that? What I did is I wanted to make sure the hardware would communicate to the user, and or to a technical person especially, and say, look, I'm running. Or if something has failed, it would be flashing an error code. Oh, an error code. And I would look at documentation, because obviously we didn't have it online at that point. So you would look at documentation and say, oh, look, error code 64, that means this, whatever. It was very helpful, especially in the manufacturing process. I mean, this, when you assemble a board and one pin didn't get into a socket, or there was the in the soldering process, maybe two pins got shorted together, it would point to where the problem was, if it was possible, unless the problem caused the processor not to work, then of course, but anyway. So those things were important. So how is that relevant for today? That same mindset is what I use in Shofar Nexus. I've used it, obviously, for, decades now. Except instead of hardware, it's software. I am emphatic on when the software does things. There's tools in there so you can see what's happening. You can see it in extreme detail. And, in my transition right now, the thing that I'm using to kind of drive things is email, very simple email. Of course, the difference is so many times, email, I just get that from Google, or I just buy an off-the-shelf package that runs on top of Linux or Windows. This runs on bare hardware. Shofar Nexus, it's designed to run bare hardware, because it doesn't use any of the features of an operating system. Right now, when it's running on Windows, it's using the operating system to get to the files. Whereas the basic mechanics is there to do that directly. But anyway, the point is, as well as communications, because again, I use when it runs on Windows, I use very little of what Windows provides for communications. The objective being is so we can go direct without Windows or Linux or anything of the nature. That is the point. And so what you see if what I've done now is there are three users who actually have live accounts: Alice, Bob, and Charles. Alice. If you go to what I have is demo.shorefarnexus.com. That's been around for a long time, and so you can go there right now, and I've demonstrated how you can go to there is a direct link the message thing or underscore message, and you can see the email messages that have come in. And for example, I'm looking at it live right now, and there's a whole bunch. The most recent one is an email that was sent to come from EU996040@tele2.it, IT Italy, to john@heritagesystems.com. So that's the email. And if you look at the log, you'll see it came in and message was rejected because Heritage Systems is not on this machine. It used to be, but it's not anymore. But so that's why. That's why that message was rejected. And it's spam anyway. I used to was accepting these things. I have a stack. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails. People sending, because they were assuming that it would be a way to transfer. Anyway, I won't go into all that. But the point is, there was one earlier. This happened at 2:18 today from john@kozlowski.org. To alice@demo.kozlowski.com, and it got there. So again, one of the big differences is it's not that, again, the obvious example. Well, I'll use my example. john@kozlowski.org. That I have a server for Kozlowski.org. So if you actually send an email to DorothyJane@Kozlowski.org or Jack or Tears or Eric Lee, whatever, those accounts would be on that same server, which is in Miami or Atlanta. It's in one of those places. Maybe it's in Texas. I don't remember. Do I have to find out? Email is in, I don't have it listed. Anyway, it's somewhere. It's in the United States. So you have the mechanics now in place, but the log that you see, and my focus has not been on the user interface to make it nice and pretty for the novice. My focus is on to make it technically sound. And so that especially a skilled person who understands this stuff can look and say, what happened? So if you click on it, there's the abbreviated log and there's the verbose log. And in that log, you can see how the transaction with the, because this, I sent from my john@kozlowski.org to that server, which in turn went to the demo at shofarnexus.com, which is on a different machine, not my demo machine. So that message was sent using the standard internet protocol, the SMTP, Simple Mail Transfer Protocol. It's been around since the 80s. It may have started in the 70s, but the basic foundation has been around for a long. Yes, I think it did start in the 70s because one of the first things that happened when the internet was to send email. But what you see, it's not a guess. I wonder, did it work? It's not, does it work or does it not work? I can see the various steps. There's the e-hello, enhance, expanded, whatever, hello message. There's the mail message, the receipt message, the data message, and the quit message. And then you see I have validation steps, which are basically just a note for me, so because that's one of the next steps to do, because there are various techniques to validate for spam and whatnot. So, but I wanted to get the basic mechanics in place. And then you'll see a processing step where I'll say, okay, I've got them. You know, if I have accepted the email, I've got it. Now, what do I do with it? So in some cases, the server will say, okay, this is supposed to be forwarded to somebody else. So I'll start the task to do that. And I have done that, and I've because I have sent from Alice to johnxl.org. But the focus, at least in the last couple of days, has been to receive. So it comes in, whether in the forwarding is another aspect, the part that I've worked on, that I've demonstrated now, is where it receives and say, oh, this is for Alice at, the email was Alice at chauffeurnexus.com. And the email server says, that's me. So it'll go into that machine. It won't forward it. It's here. It's local. It's mine. And so Alice, Bob, and Charles, all three at demo.chauffeurnexus.com are functional. You send an email to them, it arrives, and it's there. The purpose behind those is the public demo, because you can now go to, it's not, you can go to the demo site and see all the traffic at the demo site, but that's not the endpoint. The endpoint is at alice.chauffeurnexus.com or bob.chauffeurnexus, because you can have multiple email addresses going to the same collection point. Or what I call, from years ago, my family may vaguely remember this, a portfolio. Because the portfolio idea, at least the name, I think became official in probably 2011. So the idea of a portfolio, the reason the portfolio name, boy, I'm getting long. The reason the portfolio name was chosen is because often you see a portfolio, or it's kind of like, or, you know, a diary, where it has a, you know, it's kind of like a binder with a zipper around it to close it up. And, you know, obviously not all portfolios are that way, but that image, I mean, if you look at the icon that I use, that's the image I have, something that can be zipped up. The purpose behind that is because it's zipped up, it's private, it's yours alone. And the technology I have is, what, you know, right now this is unsecure. It's unsecure to show demo usability, all those kind of things. But the next step, well, a couple steps down, is to give somebody a portfolio and I can't get to it. It's something somebody else has and there's nothing I can do with it. Unlike, you know, your Gmail account, Google has access to every little bit of your data. With Chauffeur Portfolio, I've got nothing. Unless you simply say, here's my password, I've got nothing. And I mean, you physically, if I have physical access to the server, I still don't have it. Without your password, I don't have it, because the data is encrypted with your password. Your password doesn't unlock access to the data, but it actually uses it to encrypt the data. So you can't change passwords without re-encrypting the data. That's another complexity you won't get to. But the point is, if you go now to the demo.chauffeurnexus.com, you'll see the traffic coming in. But the other thing is, you can go to alice.chauffeurnexus.com and see the message that was sent to Alice. Or go to Bob see the traffic that ended up with Bob. This is a big deal. And, you know, especially, you'll see, hi, Alice, or test-email. I didn't send those. Friends did. And it worked. It got there. You know, I can look at anyway, I won't read the email. To get to this point was a big deal. Just like the LEDs that were on the Heritage Systems product, the logs, the ability to see things happening as it happens, and how it happened long ago. I mean, I could look at stuff that was done years ago, and the logs are still there. Assuming the logs are still there, and it's all there. What it does is it turns over to the end user. I know what happened. I'm trying to refine it. It's refined a lot, but try to make it so someone who is only, the absolute novice, it would probably see gobbledygook and kind of maybe run from it. But an interested novice would say, okay, let me look at this and see, because again, the log is there, and it shows the various steps. You can say, oh, that's the time. I have CPU duration, which how much time it actually spent in the CPU, which that's really not that helpful. And there's this nesting thing, but that's great for development. But anyway, but then the kind, which says what actually happened, and the status of each thing. Okay, this succeeded, this failed. Or I have this was a receive event, this was a transmit event. And then I have a detail for what is appropriate detail information for the particular command. It doesn't take someone with 10 years of experience to take a look at that and say, okay, I at least get the vague idea. And then somebody with a bit of skill can find this information extremely useful and extremely helpful, especially, for example, if you're being monitored, you're being, a variety of things. And then, of course, the ideal would be somebody says, all right, I want to take this and use it for additional purposes. Because I will hope, again, if you look at the message, you'll see the transfer of the message. You'll see in this case, it's net SMTP server and various things. This is where the message is transferred. Then you'll see some validate steps and then some process steps. The validate steps, which right now don't actually do things. Again, I do the two common things. One is called DKIM. This is domain keys, domain keys, which I can go and say, all right, you've signed the message. Now I can go to the DNS system and say, was this really signed by a valid party? Or was it spam? Is somebody lying to me? And a lot of, there's called SPF, the Sender Policy Framework, where again, you go to the DNS and say, is this really from this person? So you have those two things. But one of the differences is me as the user, I can go and say, all right, from this particular person, and this is not hidden away somewhere, the data is right there in front of you. I can say from these people, because again, the email program that I'm using for Kozlowski.org, it's just, they give you a score. I have very little configuration options here. But here, it's done by Shofar Nexus. And I could say if it comes from Kozlowski.org, I don't need to check the SPF, for example. Or if it comes from vicious.com, I could say, either reject it, or I want validate, make sure that the domain keys or the SPF is valid, one or the other or both. I have the individual control if I wanted that. And I push this into the hands of the user. But there's another, which obviously is important for spam and things of that nature. But there's the other aspect, and you'll see validate and then image. When you get an email sent to you, especially by a marketing company, or by a company that you get a bill from, or you've ordered something online, there's typically a lot of images, and a lot of times those images are not embedded in the email, but they're linked into the email. So they are not part of the email, but when you get the email and you open it with your email program, it goes and gets those images at that time. And what is happening? It's telling the other party where you are and when you look at the email. For a lot of cases, if it's, I am, my friend Chris, for example, at Metro Expedite, or Metro Transport Group, that link will be in there to go get his company logo. And that's, I doubt there's any tracing being done by them. Google does it. Facebook, Twitter, if you use any of those services, Gmail, a marketing company, they do it. Some go even one step further. They'll put, they're called invisible gifts or things of that nature, an image that you won't see, but it goes to a particular location in order to, specifically, the only purpose for that is to track you. And then there's the really inventive ones where the domain name for it is something, some, 123456742IMRQ, whatever, at itraceyou.com. And it's a unique domain name, because what that does, it not only tells the server that viewed the email, but it also tells the parties that are doing the DNS system, like, for example, your ISP, or your ISP quite probably uses Google. Google provides domain name services basically for free because it's a tracking tool. So you have all these techniques, and again, for most people, what I've just talked about is just absolutely mumbo-jumbo. It means nothing to them. And they don't see how that tiny little bit of information is a threat to them. And it really is. There's a solution, and that's what you see, the validate image. When your email arrives at the server says, "Oh, look, I will examine your email for you, and what I see is links to outside images. I'll do you a favor. I'll go get those images now and embed them as part of the package of the email." So when you get the email, you're getting the email with all the images embedded, as opposed to having to go fetch them. It makes the email a whole bunch bigger, because now you have not only all the text and whatnot, but you have all those images. So a modest email becomes maybe 10 times larger or more. But you're going to do that anyway when you read the email. But what happens is the sending party sends the email, goes to their server, comes to your server, and that's collecting the email, and it fetches the email immediately. So as far as the receiving, the tracking party is concerned, they send it, 1 second after midnight, and you watched it or read it 2 seconds after midnight from the server. When you got it and looked at it at 8 o'clock in the morning, there's no tracking. These are the techniques to get around the overlords. Overlords. Have you heard somebody use that term? It's to get away from the overlords, those who are trying to watch you. This is an intensely big deal. But the people who understand this stuff, the vast majority of them are the people who are doing it. They come up with these inventive ways to track you. The people who say, I want to protect you, are few and far between. And a lot of them run into trouble. Because obviously the people who are trying to track you don't want this to happen. I have been told that directly. So this is what is being part of Shofar Nexus. And obviously the objective is to give it away, so others can do this. Because with so many of the Silent Circle, the Lava Bit, or the the various providers that give you a lot of protection. Well, they give you a lot of protection. A lot of them get compromised, and a lot of them get shut down. This does happen. So the solution is, don't use them. Do it yourself. And instead of having one or a half a dozen, to literally have thousands of people doing this, it becomes an army. And that's the goal. Because, right now, got ridiculously long. Right now, I had several other things, and I won't go into them. Right now, in the U.S., we can still get around this fairly easy, but it's reducing. You can see it reducing in a lot of ways. But as I pointed out, in Austria, things that I do with Shofar Nexus are now illegal. Because the government doesn't want you to be anonymous. I mean, that is the stated goal, to keep you from being anonymous. Obviously, in China, that's very true. It's happening in many other places. And it's coming strongly to the U.S. Because you have a right to an identity. That's the marketing line. But you don't have a right to anonymity. Anonymity is vital. So that is why I'm doing this. That is fundamentally why I'm doing this. Because without anonymity, you will be controlled. And that is the purpose of knowing everything about you. So one last thing about I haven't uploaded that. I have to upload that. It's not there yet. It's on my local machine. I got to upload it. But if you go to, alice.shofarnexus.com and bob@shofarnexus.com and charles@shofarnexus.com and look at the top left, basically the home button. Basically all the screens have a large button at the top left. So you can click that and you get back to whatever is home for that particular site. And there's an icon, Charles. I found this one and I like it. It's a guy wearing a hat and with some glasses and whatnot and a suit kind of thing. So very dignified, Charles. Bob, guy with a blue shirt and a similar hairstyle to mine except inverted, but otherwise a nondescript round face. There's no features, no eyes, ears, nose. It's a simple icon. I think it's a very good icon. And then, of course, there's Alice, clearly a woman wearing a red shirt. And the reason I chose that one, and this is unambiguous again, she has the long black hair. She reminds me of my wife. So when you look at Alice, I have the three icons. They're embedded into Shofar Nexus. Alice, Bob, and Charles. Again, Alice to Bob is the I think that dates back to the 70s too, and maybe 80s. But that is the constant way. You can even find this in Wikipedia. That's the way you test messages. That's how that came, because Alice, Bob, Charles, and it goes on. But Alice and Bob, A, B, Charles, C. But the reason I chose that icon is so that when anybody sees this and knows about this, they all know that's a man who's in love with his wife. And he used an icon that reminds him of his wife. That is why I use that icon. No ifs, ands, or buts. That is why I use that icon. Because the woman it reminds me of, I'm very fond of. I am still this day. I love that lady. This is a very different email, voicemail. Got really long, bunch of technical gobbledygook. But it does help me. When I find that when I do this, it helps me, because I need to reach people that can do this better, do the explaining part better, and would find it useful to them. But anyway, Alice, Dorothy Jane, my lady, the woman I love and adore. An icon of you has been embedded. Okay, one more quick thing. Within Shofar Nexus, there are techniques to have, there's what's called, I call the branch system. So within a URL, what you'll have on today's email is the link to the image of the HSC 5100 computer. When you go there, you'll see there are eight images of the computer and related things. And if you look at the URL, it's kozlowski.org/HSC-5100+1+2+3. That plus thing is because it's a number. That number could be 1,2,3,3,724, 1,486,722, 14,586,724, and don't ask me to repeat those numbers. But there's a technique that I use in order to make, because this is not a database, it's a tree. And to have that many numbers, the mechanics to make it simple, I had to be inventive. And I suggest the technique that's used, which I won't explain at this point, I want to keep this under 3 hours, is rather inventive for the structure. But what I needed is to be able to say a branch, an object within Shofar Nexus, a named object, can have a name of up to 63 bytes. It's actually 64 in memory, but the last byte is almost a zero. To indicate the, you know, because it's in the, it's this called a string in, you know, C, where it's null terminated. Anyway, I won't go into that. But it has a fixed amount of space, 64 bytes, always a zero at the end. So it could be short as, you know, well, like for example, Alice. So that's what, five letters. Then the sixth will be a zero. Actually, the rest of it will be zeros. That's all well and good, but I want to have this thing where I can do numbers. I can do number 1, 2, 3. It could simply be the characters 1, 2, 3. But when I have this huge array of numbers, I needed a different mechanics. So, a branch that has, for example, a branch 1, 2, 3, will have the name 1, 2, 3 followed by the null sign. But at the end of it, the 64th byte is not a null, it's a non-zero value. And so what I needed to do is because if it's numbers, it's only going to be a limited number of numbers. It's a maximum of, it's 30 some digits, whatever. The bulk of the end will always never be full of zeros. So at the very end, I'm going to have a non-zero value. So I can do a quick check to say, oh, this is the number. But I had to put a value there. And actually, it's an eight byte value. And, I was thinking, okay, instead of a zero, you know, I could do a one. That would work. Or I could use, I have 8 bytes. What could I use? Maybe I love DJ. 7 characters. So the expression I love DJ is generated because this is happening all over the place. It's happening at gas stations. that little I love DJ is used constantly, literally in numerous places around the world. It's an embedded part of Shofar Nexus. It's been there for years. Because my love for Dorothy Jane has been there for many years. And just like the icon for Alice, embedded within Shofar Nexus, is that constant reminder. I love DJ. Dorothy Jane, my lady. I really do love you. It's not fluff. It's not just quaintness. I love you and I want you back.